You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
Hello, this is Tim Rice. Welcome to the 10th episode of my podcast, Get Onto My Cloud. Move It by Cliff Richard. His first UK hit in 1958, which has been followed over the past 60 years by over 100 others. I didn't write that song, but I wish I had. It was actually written by Ian Samwell, a member of Cliff's backing group, The Drifters, later, of course, The Shadows. I've been an admirer of Cliff Richard since Move It, although my credentials as a Cliff fan got off to a rocky start. Move It was initially intended to be the B-side of Cliff's cover of a recent American hit by Bobby Helms entitled Schoolboy Crush. As such, it was competing with the Bobby Helms original, which I heard on Radio Luxembourg and quite liked. I was only 13, I hasten to add. The conventional view then held by teenage record buyers in the UK was that the American original was always superior to the British copy. So even though I'd heard the unknown Cliff Richard version, I opted to buy Bobby Helms, which in all honesty was probably just better. Meanwhile, Cliff's record company EMI, initially at the insistence of his producer, Norrie Paramore's daughter Carolyn, realised that they were sitting on a potential winner with Move It. The B-side became the A-side, and Move It shot speedily to number two in the UK charts. Not bought by me, as I had already forked out a month's pocket money on Mr. Helms. But I bought Cliff's follow-up High Class Baby, not quite as good as Move It, and nearly everything he's recorded since. I first met Cliff in 1966, when I was 23 and working in a very junior capacity at EMI Records. The low rung of the ladder that I occupied was in the legendary Norrie Paramore's office. Norrie was the company's senior record producer, and Cliff Richard still his leading recording artist. I went to many of his sessions at Abbey Road, and although my tasks were generally confined to setting up music stands, labelling tape boxes, and getting coffee, I learnt a great deal about the recording studio and about Cliff's consummate professionalism. I remember Paul McCartney dropping in at one of Cliff's sessions to say hello and feeling a combination of starstruck excitement and abject terror in case one of these musical titans asked for my views on anything, or even for a cup of coffee. When Andrew Lloyd Webber and I were lucky enough to make our own mark in the record business in 1970 via Jesus Christ Superstar, we often crossed paths with Cliff, and at one point had serious discussions about him taking the lead in a new production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, which, sad to say, did not materialise. I was nevertheless hopeful that he might record one of our songs one day, or to be more ruthless about it, one of my songs, as by the 1980s, Andrew and I were not working together on any major projects. By the 1990s, I was still waiting for the first Cliff Richard recording of one of my songs, so I was intrigued when he invited me to dinner with Frank Dunlop, the great theatrical director, who had directed the first professional stage production of Joseph back in 1972. Virtually every production of Joseph done since 1972 owes a great deal to Frank's version at the Edinburgh Festival that year. Anyway, I think this dinner must have taken place in late 1991 or early 1992, and when Cliff said that to make up for the total absence of T. Rice works in his CV or resume, he would like me to write an entire show for him, I was more than taken aback. It was to be based on the immortal novel Wuthering Heights, was to be directed by Frank, and the music would be written by John Farrar. The adaptation of the Bronte story would be written by Cliff and Frank, and Heathcliff, rather than Cathy, was to be the central character. And Cliff himself would play Heathcliff, an ambition he'd had for many years, and indeed had spoken about in various interviews for a long time. John Farrar's most famous compositions are probably those he wrote for the staggeringly successful film of the musical Grease, notably You're the One That I Want, which was the number one record around the world for John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John. John is an Australian composer, record producer and orchestrator who has long been based in Los Angeles. He was for a while a member of The Shadows, and he wrote and produced several other massive successes for Olivia. In short, a top bloke creatively, and as I soon discovered, personally. I left the restaurant that night having accepted the gig purely on the strength of the team behind Heathcliff. I had not read Wuthering Heights, although I knew, of course, the superb 1977 Kate Bush song of that title, which I knew would be a tricky, if not impossible, standard to match. Kate never expanded Wuthering Heights beyond her number one hit single. Did she know something we didn't? By late 1992, John and I were well into creating the songs for the show, helped by the fact that I was often in LA working on Aladdin and The Lion King. The plan was for the show to tour arenas around the UK, rather than to kick off in the West End in a more conventional musical theatre setting. But Cliff would guarantee sellouts in these substantial venues, even though he would obviously not be performing any of his 35-year tally of hits. One thing we did not have to worry about was advanced bookings. There were plenty of other things to worry about, as is the case with all shows. John and I took longer to complete the score than originally intended, so the arena dates that had been booked for Heathcliff featured instead a Cliff Richard Greatest Hits tour, which was inevitably and deservedly an outstanding success. One of the first songs we did complete was entitled Misunderstood Man. This song was released as the first single in October 1995, nearly a year before the show itself. Who was the misunderstood man? Well, of course, for the show, it was Heathcliff. But some of the lines I wrote could apply to Cliff himself, too. As a longtime friend and colleague of Cliff Richard, I definitely hoped that some listeners would pick up on the fact that Cliff himself has often been misunderstood, even underrated in some areas, despite his phenomenal achievements. I'm not sure anybody did pick up on that, but thinking of the song's performer as much as of the song's character certainly helped me write it. Plus, of course, John's driving melody. Soon after A Misunderstood Man's foray into the top 20, a studio album of 10 songs from the forthcoming show was released, and 5 of the songs featured Olivia Newton-John in duets with Cliff. This created considerable interest in the show well beyond Cliff's extensive fan base. The media, of course, delighted in speculating that Cliff Richard, whose image was perceived as polite, Christian, clean-living, singer of gentle love ballads, could not possibly portray the brutal and vicious Heathcliff. In the meantime, box office records were broken for first-week ticket sales in Birmingham, Edinburgh, Manchester, and Hammersmith in London. I remember one brilliant headline, I think in the Sun newspaper, which did a feature on Cliff's physical workouts in preparation for the show, and they called the item Beef Cliff. In the meantime, ticket sales continued to mount, the album sold well, and Cliff took me and his leading lady for the show, Helen Hobson, on a whistle-stop helicopter trip, promoting the show at the venues that Heathcliff would grace. I don't like helicopters. And a second single was released. This was a duet between Heathcliff and Kathy in the shapes of Cliff and Olivia. The song was called Had to Be, and I think it's the best one in the score.
Doubt, no way out. Seeing you, it was easy to decide. Cut and dry, had to be. Now we know why we exist. Don't resist. Don't even think at all, simply fall in love. This is what had to be. She was easy to seduce, let her loose. Where the fake and shallow shine, she'll be fine. Had to be. She's a woman, nothing more. Falling for whatever comes along, she's so wrong.
Stains the echo of the
smile for a while.
No one can tell me
we're fools to ourselves. Have to be.
No one has told me
we're fools to ourselves.
Like Misunderstood Man, the single of Had to Be did okay. I do an occasional An Evening with Tim Rice and Friends show, usually for some fundraising cause, the cause not being me, unfortunately, me and three or four singers and a small band, and the song selection is fairly predictable. Argentina, Any Dream Will Do, I Know Him So Well, Whole New World, Circle of Life, etc., which is what people like to hear. But I do occasionally slip in the odd lesser-known number, and there have been some wonderful versions of Had to Be here and there. It is one of my favourite songs. Anyway, Heathcliff opened in the National Indoor Arena in Birmingham on October the 16th, 1996. Total advance takings were by then £8.5 million. It went down a storm with the fans, but was massacred by the critics, who were clearly praying for something they could be rude about. And they were. Quotes such as withering rather than wuthering, living dull, were bravely used later by Cliff's production company in adverts, contrasted with fans' ecstatic comments and box office figures. Helen Hobson as Kathy did get good notices, but the songs and staging barely inspired much comment one way or the other. Cliff himself was simultaneously the show's greatest asset and its greatest problem, the latter because most reviewers and critics refused to separate his real-life persona from his portrayal of a violent, often crude and cruel, protagonist. The book, fashioned by Cliff and Frank Dunlop, used dialogue directly from the Bronte novel, which clashed stylistically with the lyrics and indeed the music of the score. The piece fell between the two stools of concert and theatre, with the former winning out, as a Cliff Richard arena rock performance, inspired by a traditional but complex love story, it hit home wonderfully with the thousands of fans. As something that could have transferred to the West End, not that that was ever the intention, no way, Jose. But Cliff had achieved his long-held desire to play Heathcliff, and I was honoured to have been invited to help. As ever, he gave his all, and his audiences loved it. Had it been a conventional stage musical in the West End, I think it would have had to have been a radically different piece. In that situation, there would have been a need for much more to be made of the role of Kathy, a clearer storyline in contemporary language, and a stronger dramatic flow from scene to scene. What the punters got in the stadia and big halls was a series of tableau that gave Cliff the chance to do what he did best. And what I got was a chance to work with an outstanding composer in John Farrar and a true British music legend in Cliff Richard. Even the live album of the entire show sold well. I'll end my wuthering tale with a short extract of the Heathcliff Company singing I Do Not Love You, Isabella. Isabella is played by Sarah Hafferty, who marries Heathcliff after he becomes the owner of Wuthering Heights, despite his obvious lack of love for her.
I shall not stay, poor Isabella. Never heed my marriage vow. Believe in time you won't regret this, though it may disturb you now. Abandon all attempts to love me. Don't fool yourself, that's what you feel. When you at last decide to hate me, at least your emotion will be real.
Wolfish, savage, tuned to madness. Love is stifled, joy denied.
I adore him, no misgiving.
Isabella, I never never have, I never will. I saunter through this ceremony, confidence high, enthusiasm nil. My reasoning need not detain you, but woman, it's not all bad news. Very few find peace and succor in the spouse or life that they choose. They
That was episode 10 of Get Onto My Cloud, written and presented by Tim Rice and produced by Peter Hobbs.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
You haven't heard about the McCrispy yet? Well then, you probably haven't heard the sweet silence after the first crispy bite either. Go try it for yourself to hear the best not sound you've ever heard.
The Outsiders, Essie Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the SUFS. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, SUFS celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. SUFS has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.